The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Broadband. Get the power to do more with Sky's best ever Wi-Fi.
At 9.27 thereabouts this Wednesday morning, very good to have you with us. Róisín Kybert is a Dublin writer. She's focusing on technology and culture and the intersection between the two, because we are just obsessed with technology these days. Róisín, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on your show.
Not at all. Congratulations on your... Well, it's a collection of essays. That really... what I'm so happy about talking to you this morning is largely because of the year you were born.
1989.
Precisely, which makes you... Does it make you a digital native or not? Am I right in saying that?
Oh, very much so. Yeah. I start my book. It's called The Disconnect.
Yeah.
And it's out in a few days. But I started with a history of the world since 1989, beginning with March 1989, when Tim Berners-Lee first filed the kind of... he first created the outline of the WWW layer of the internet. So we could say I'm exactly as old as the World Wide Web.
You are the World Wide Web.
I'm raised by the internet. In the book.
Yeah, indeed. And raised by internet wolves in many respects, because it's one of those, there's a beauty and a menace to the internet, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. That sums it up so perfectly. And that's what I wanted to capture in The Disconnect, actually. It was that, you know, it's not purely a darkness, but there is a lot of darkness there. And I think it's something an entire generation can speak to, and everyone younger than me too, I would imagine.
You were 12, you got the Nokia 8210, and was that the right age to get the phone? I think that sounds about normal these days, isn't it?
Yeah, I could even imagine people getting them younger now, actually, and parents telling themselves that it's a necessity, and I wouldn't disagree with them. I think something that's interesting is, I'm old enough to have caught the last of the benign internet, young enough to probably have experienced it also at its worst.
Take us back, Róisín, to the benign internet times, because there's so many people listening going, what is this Oz you speak of?
Yeah, I think one where it was more segmented according to interest. So it wasn't this big, endless scrolling timeline of just angry voices clashing with each other, you know?
Yeah.
It was people actually building their own websites, customizing them.
Yeah.
There was so much more creativity as well. I kind of have almost a moment of original sin for the internet being the invention of Facebook, because suddenly we had to use our real names. And we had to make our entire personalities fit into this grid of just, you know, boring white and blue, and everything has to be very proper and bland. I have a chapter in The Disconnect called Bland God, Notes on Mark Zuckerberg. I really do see him as a merchant of blandness in the world.
What a great description of obviously an incredibly smart guy, but a poster boy for everything that is bland and vanilla. And largely uninteresting. Yeah. Why is that? And how do we get sucked into such basic nonsense?
I'm really interested in this, actually. I think there's this idea that dates back to around the 90s of the personal brand. So the internet is going to, you know, they knew at that time, the internet is going to change work. It's going to change relationships. It's going to change everything about how we behave in everyday life.
Yes.
And you will only really be as good as your presence on the internet. So you have to market yourself like a brand.
So you're defined by your presence online.
Yeah. And I think that caught on originally with maybe first these kind of business ebook guys, and then later, you know, MySpace and these kind of mad creatives. But then the most normal version, or in the book I describe it as normcore, is Facebook, where it's that sort of one-size-fits-all. Here's your page, and now talk to each other, but don't say anything too exciting, you know?
Yeah. Because you'd be called out for being different.
Yeah, potentially. I think there is something very conformist about Facebook. But then, I mean, that's confounding, because now it's a home of conspiracies. I mean, I would blame a lot of QAnon and even what happened at the weekend in Ireland on Facebook, personally. I mean, they're facilitating conspiracy theories right now.
Indeed. In fact, a lot of the online big corporate head companies are doing a lot of facilitating and enabling and propagating, and while at the same time shrugging their shoulders like an emoji saying, what, us? We just give you the wall. I don't care. We're not responsible for the graffiti.
I think you've probably seen it over the years in that, like, a company like Facebook, the impact that it has had on media alone is beyond measure, and yet they refuse to, you know, take accountability for that. They say they're not a media company, but in so many ways they are. I mean, I kind of allude to it a little bit in the first chapter in the book, but I worked as a journalist for years, and I watched as so many places went bankrupt or else kind of went into chaos trying to adapt to the internet, trying to create content. It's always that word, content. And, you know, it was catering to what Facebook wanted from them, but ultimately Facebook doesn't care.
Because they want to what?
Well, for instance, I used to write a column for Motherboard, and at the beginning of The Disconnect, I'm still writing that column, and it's studying internet subcultures. But about a year or two later, a lot of journalists lost their jobs because Facebook told them video content is more important. And so they fired the journalists and they hired videographers. And then it turned out Facebook was lying about its metrics, and the videos weren't getting as much interaction as they said.
And that changes everything. You talk about, because you got into the technology game and you became a cheese for a while.
I did.
Roisin. Yes. It's not every day to ask somebody about their life as a cheese, but maybe throw some light on that for us, please.
My year as a cheese, yeah, it was a formative experience. It's in the first chapter of The Disconnect. I kind of begin with myself working in London at an ad agency where they were just beginning to get in on social media. And by the end of the year I spent there, they had moved a lot of people onto the social media team because it was obvious this is not something you can wait for, you know? Mm. But they assigned me this brand of cheddar cheese. So I spent my days talking mostly to teenage girls about cheddar cheese. And then at one point, Harry Styles said that it was his favorite food and that he missed it in an interview. He missed it in England. And so suddenly I had this influx of One Direction fans. And that became my sort of day-to-day life, just talking, trying to convince these girls to buy cheese. And they were trying to convince me to connect them to Harry Styles, even though I'm just a cheese, what can I do?
Yeah,
that was an odd job. But yeah. I mean, that to me that epitomizes just the kind of mundane, surreal quality, you know, that the internet has. And I mean, that was a mission of mine with writing The Disconnect. I want to point out the kind of everyday but utterly strange things that technology has done to everyday life.
Yeah, it's hard for you, I suspect, to write about it because I feel it's such an evolving story in the sense that we still don't know quite how controlled we are by this thing, the phone in the pocket, the internet. The service, the online companies I just mentioned, you know, it'll take probably another little while for us to realise that we walked eyes wide open into a cesspit. Too often, it's a cesspit. Anyway, let's talk about your the idea of you with the phone going home. And like so many people, this is what I'm talking about as well, not just a cesspit because the internet has great things, et cetera, but you can go home with your phone and suddenly you're on 24/7. And yeah. you found that too. I mean, it's kind of insidious way of getting at you.
I think so. I think, you know, when the pandemic started, I kind of thought, oh no, I'm launching a book in lockdown. Mm. I think it's more relevant than ever, actually, because now that boundary between work and your private life and your personal, like your time, has completely collapsed. You know, I've been a freelancer for a long time, so I had to reckon with this before everyone else. But it's the first kind of three essays in the book are about this, about being always on and about how the body is almost treated as a machine. And you see that in so much of the rhetoric coming out of Silicon Valley, this obsession with productivity, with, you know, controlling, with optimizing the self. But for the average person, like for me, working, living in Dublin, writing about the internet, I kind of took that on way too much personally. And I have this chapter in the book called The Night Gym, and it's about my time going to a 24-hour super gym. Yes. In the Docklands. I would spend, and you know, at the time, I think this is like a disconnect. I had just sunk so deep into really disordered thinking. I mean, I'm quite an obsessive person. I think writers tend to be that way.
Yes. You were doing that thing so many people are doing for some weird reason, listening to podcasts about serial killers.
Oh, very much so, yes. Walking through town at night, listening to podcasts about serial killers.
Perfect background ambience for your walk through the city centre.
Yes. But there's something so noirish about the Docklands anyway, and it was only later that I realised, like, I brought that essay out first in the Dublin Review, and I remember someone said that it reminded them of an Edward Hopper painting,
yeah.
But of tech Dublin.
Yes, yeah. That's our Silicon Docklands.
Yeah, and then that kind of extreme, you know, nature of just like, the internet never sleeps, so you shouldn't sleep either.
Yes.
It fascinates me. I see it mapping out into so many, like, you don't have to be a freelancer to be always on now. If you have a phone, you carry your work around with you, and young people especially, they don't know how to say no, because they're scared that they'll lose their jobs, or, you know, that they won't get work anymore, so they just do that. But then they become almost like automata, you know?
Yes, yeah. I think it'd be terrifying to be heading into the workplace for the first time now. And as you say at one point, if you're feeling isolated or lonely, you go on Twitter and get into a fight. Or if you're worried about the virus, you download the tracking app. You know, all the answers are to be found in technology, according to what we're being told, whereas actually a walk by the sea or look up at a tree and watch a bird making a nest actually could be much more rewarding.
Completely. I think technology offers itself as the cure for technology.
Okay, for sure. You had your own, I suppose, troubles in some ways with burnout and...
Yeah.
You just I think people get that burnout, and it's kind of hard to define, because it's I don't think there's necessarily a medical definition for it. But what happened in your case, Roisin?
Yeah, I begin the book with this. The disconnect is roughly like a kind of linear journey. It looks like a very winding journey, but for me it was a linear one. I start on a point of complete alienation and kind of paranoia. And really, ultimately, when I look back, it's the kind of state that the internet wants you to be in, always connected, always,
yes.
You know, your kind of brain chemicals flaring, ready to react, and ultimately very detached from the rest of humanity. So I was barely sleeping. I have like a history of eating disorders as well. And I kind of got in this idea that I had the perfect routine, which is so deceptive, that, you know, I was successful because I was working all the time and then running on a treadmill at 4 in the morning, like in the Docklands at night. And ultimately, I just had a breakdown. I had a complete breakdown. And I had to go into treatment. I got CBT after going on a waiting list for a long time, and that helped a lot. But the other thing was a kind of self-knowledge, you know, with a lot of professional help too, but also just on my own. I think one thing I didn't have when I started the book, but that I have now at the end, is a kind of self-knowledge when I'm scrolling, you know, the infinite scroll. It's never going to end. There will always be distraction there. But if it's hurting me, or if it's kind of uncomfortable, you know, it's like I'm just not actually any happier reading this, mainlining information, then I step away.
Exactly. And it's the self-discipline to know when to start. I see people, and, you know, they might be, not necessarily working, but around the place and scrolling, but they look dead behind the eyes. Like, what is it? Scrolling.
Never,
just head deep into the phone, just going, like a hamster's wheel of death.
Yeah, you'll never run out of internet.
But what are you scrolling for? Like, what is the dopamine hit in that? It doesn't seem to, I never see them looking up for a moment going, oh, I found it. I found what I was looking for. A meaningful message amongst all of this. The reeds of nothingness.
Oh, there's a lot of nothingness. I mean, it's something. I've read some really startling statistic, like the majority of the internet is spam. And I think then when we broaden the definition of spam to include just the kind of mundanities that we put up online every day, it's all spam almost. I mean, it was really important to me to capture this time of transition, you know, that this thing has crept into our lives and completely insinuated itself. And I'm not purely negative about this. There is a lot of, like, there's beauty. There's a kind of tragic beauty to some of the things that happen online. Like, I have an entire chapter in The Disconnect on vaporwave music, which is this weird, you know, kind of nostalgic, sad genre of music and art, produced mainly by millennials. And to me, it expresses perfectly the sort of loneliness and defeat, but also a sort of beautiful sense of nostalgia and expert curation. People are so good at curating things now because they're on the internet. They're like swimming in information. And people are developing these weird new, you know, art forms there. So I did want to include the positives too.
Yeah, I think it's really important to talk about the positives too, because it's too easy for curmudgeons like me on this subject to take over and to kind of point out, to extenuate the negative. But you're right, and there are some beautiful things in it. But I loved your description of the internet as being something akin to the Garden of Eden, and then the original sin of Facebook arrived. I don't want to be too harsh on Facebook. I find Facebook, particularly on I think they own Instagram, they're very good. If something awful happens on Instagram, they'll take it down very quickly. I notice in my own, if somebody puts up a fake ID, they'll take it down really quickly. So kudos to them. Twitter, on the other hand, desperate. Don't do it at all. You have to knock and knock and knock on the door, and you mightn't even get an answer. So some are better than others, let's face it. But there are good things happening there. Tech says, I have a simple solution for all these tech companies. If you don't like their activities, which I despise, says this texter, simply stop using them. I don't use Google or Facebook. I refuse to check my phone for work purposes. We have the power. Just stop doing what these companies want you to do. And another from Stephen in Limerick says, I'm interested in your conversation about technology and the internet. I'm working currently on a dissertation about technology and teaching and learning in secondary schools. To a large degree, we are unquestioning about its use and how to use it and the real benefits of using it to help students to learn. We kind of drank the Kool-Aid, didn't we?
Yeah, this issue of there being an off button, I think that's really fascinating. Like, there's this infamous interview that one of the heads of Google gave a few years ago. It's the one that the line, I think it's Larry Page, it's the line, you know, we don't need you to tell us your information. We already know it. We can see where you are. We know basically what you're thinking. And he goes on to say later in that interview, but of course, there is an off button. You can remember to press the off button. And it's almost smug when he says it. So I made a point in my book of not telling people, oh, delete your accounts. Because honestly, I don't believe that's an option for a lot of people. I know that sounds like a lazy excuse, but I noticed that the people who tend to advocate this are safely installed in careers where they didn't need social media to succeed initially. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's a total journalist's reply or a writer's reply, because obviously I have to use it more than most. And originally, the only people on Twitter were journalists. But I think it's kind of different for people below a certain generation. And I also would I would kind of argue that there is no off button, because surveillance capitalism, as it's called, it has really, like, it's in every aspect of our lives. I know a lot of, like, I live in Berlin most of the time now, which is this, you know, famously kind of a city of spies, and the legacy of the Stasi is there. And consequently, a lot of people hate tech. There are protests against Amazon. They ran Google out of Kreuzberg. But there and a lot of very data-conscious people who try to hide their information, and they might not even use credit cards. You know, everyone pays cash in Berlin. They still sometimes have to use these products. Like, and I think the most kind of telling detail is that I talk a lot in The Disconnect about patents filed by Facebook and various things that, like, we don't really see, but we have evidence of in the outside world that Facebook is doing behind the scenes. But, like, the shadow profile, the idea that you don't have to join Facebook for Facebook to know you exist and to create a profile based around your absence.
You're terrifying me now with this information. I thought you were a nice person, an intelligent person, and now you're just scaring me. So that's
it's a dark book.
I know. No wonder you live in Berlin. You need a bohemian escape from reality to live there. I'd say it's a great old city.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's full of Irish people who can't afford to live in Dublin anymore. Because Google is raising the price of the city.
Maybe that's the whole point of the book.
It might be.
Google are pricing young people out of the housing market. But look at Berlin. Did you ever read a book called Stasiland by Anna Funder, Roisin? So you know that book is all about that. Just your description of people being so conscious of their information and their privacy is intriguing. Very interesting listening to your guest talk about Mark Zuckerberg, says the text. Might very true that he is a merchant of blandness. I think young people need a new punk movement to shake things up, just to breathe some life into the mundane. I love that because it's something that's in the last 5 years or so I've been trying to perpetrate on the toy show, of all things, Roisin. I know we're going all over the shop here.
This is your agenda.
This is my agenda, is to try and embrace those kids who are a bit more punk, a bit more, just a little less Zuckerberg and a little more punk, because they are, they're not conforming and they're not trying to, they're not trying too hard. They're just those kids and those cats and those people that you meet in real life who are just a bit off the beaten track. We need more of them.
Yeah, definitely. I think there is a real like flourishing of creativity, and it's so splintered around the world. I mean, it's a kind of cliche to say it, but you could just be a kid living in the middle of nowhere in your bedroom, like practicing some creative art. Like, I've basically rigged my entire social media accounts now that all I see when I log in is stuff that makes me happy, which is, you know, creative
stuff. A utopian
stuff.
Echo chamber, yes.
That's it. I have built my own echo chamber, and I really would advise people to do this. It's something, like, it can be your friend, like, you know, your extremely vocal political friend who you agree with in real life. But on the internet, you're seeing this magnified persona, this personal brand version of them where they may not even believe what they're saying. But, and I don't think it's a crime to mute them.
Yes. No, I couldn't agree with you more. It's just that when you see ordinarily right-thinking people head down the other echo chamber, which is suited to their needs, and that becomes the QAnon crazy horse stables. But anyway, that's for another day. Roisin, I have to go. Congratulations on The Disconnect. It's going to be finding a home on the shelf in my house, because I know I have a very interested party in what you have to say at home. So that's great. And we were all saying that upstairs. Everyone was saying, oh, I want to give that to my son, nephew, niece. And in other words, the people closer to your age than mine. But
the people you're worried about.
Yeah, I suppose so. But it's an important book for the people like me who want to know what people like them are thinking. So everyone's winning.
Yeah.
You know. Good luck in Berlin.
Thank you so much.
When you get there, I should say. Not at all. Congratulations.
Well, when they allow Irish people back.
Exactly. Get on the first plane out of Dodge for sure. Roisin Kiber, thank you for your time this morning. Congratulations on your book, The Disconnect. It's published by Serpent's Tail. It's available now. And like I say, an intriguing insight into the digital natives' trip through that whole murky morass, and beautifully put together, I must say. 12 minutes to 10.